from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listening to Strange Fruit from Home. We are still well into quarantine, but I have found, as I mentioned to you all last week, so Docu and I have both been enjoying the show P-Valley on the Stars Network.
Yes, Uncle Clifford, All Day, Mercedes, and Miss Mississippi. Those are my all-time faves. And in fact, I just posted something to Instagram saying how much I love P-Valley, and I've been watched the whole season, binged watched the whole season this weekend. And Gidget, one of the cast members, Gidget, she plays Gidget in the show. She sent me something back. And the stripper, I don't know the character's name, but the one who like eats the wings all the time and farts on everything.
Is that Extra Extra? Or that the other one?
I think it's Extra Extra. I think her name is either Tess or something like that, one of the characters. But they both wrote on my post, like, thanks for the love down in the valley.
What was this on Instagram?
Yeah, it was on Instagram, and they like, I mean, all I did was do hashtag P-Valley, but they...
Oh, well, that's cool. Yeah. So listeners, if you don't know, P-Valley is the show about a strip club down in the Mississippi Delta, and it's a really wonderful show. And stay tuned. We're going to talk about it more in the coming weeks and try to get some of the cast members to interview them. But so I said I'd like to say that I'm either spending this time binge watching shows like P-Valley and or reading books. And I've just discovered a really wonderful book, y'all, that especially for my other cis gay men out there, or even trans, any gay man, trans gay man, bisexual queer man, like this book is really, it's awesome. It's a how-to. It's a guide to life. You know, quite frankly, I wish I had discovered it, Doc, several years ago, except it wasn't written yet. But, you know, like, here I am, I find myself, having just turned 40, and, you know, and trying to figure out things about life, right? And so trying to either, you know, evaluate what the next 40 years of my life look like as a gay man, facing the prospect of being single and childless, you know, but then also kind of reminiscing over my wonderful love and romantic relationships. You know, trying to figure out what does a career look like for me? What does it look like as a 20-year-old gay man? How does it look as into my 40s? And so this book just has so much about life. And of course, my other best friend, Tori, who lives in Baltimore, and he, on the other hand, is in a long-term relationship, and he has foster children, and he has a wonderful career. And even we call each other, he's trying to figure out certain things, and he talks about things that make him unhappy, or things that inspire him, and I do the same. And so this book is really, really, really wonderful kind of how-to, if you will, a cautionary tale, a Bible, just all the above. And it really is a book for gay men to help us. Yeah, it really is, you know, in terms of instruction. It really is a Bible in terms of a book of instructions of how to make sense of a lot of things. And so we want to welcome to the show, without further ado, the author of this book. Welcome to the show, Britt East. Hey, Britt, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
It's a delight to have you. The book is called A Gay Man's Guide to Life, Get Real, Stand Tall, and Take Your Place. It was released in a hardcover on June the 2nd this past summer from Houndstooth Press. And this book, Britt, I tell you what, as I checked out the book, I made so many notes in the margins, right? You cover a lot of areas in this book, and I just want to tell our listeners, you cover several kind of key topics. You cover body, mind, spirit, career, finances, family, friends, sex, community work, and service work. And so those are kind of like the key, 10 or so areas that you kind of go over with us. But let's start from the very beginning, Britt. Who are you? How did you come to write this book? And why should we take your word for any of this stuff?
Well, don't hold back. Don't mince any words. Just ask it straight out. I love it.
That's right.
You know, I've been doing this work for 2 decades. And 2 decades ago is when my life kind of fell apart. And I started my personal growth and spiritual reawakening and recovery. And all along that way, I've been a writer my entire life. So all along that way, people were telling me, as I was doing speaking events and stuff, like, hey, you got to write your book. Your story is so crazy. You got to write it all down. And I just was reluctant. It just felt really weird to me that, you know, I would monetize my memoir and kind of, you know, everybody I know was still alive and walking the planet. And it just felt weird to spill the beans and stuff. So I hesitated for a long time. And finally, I was working with somebody who helped me understand that maybe if I flipped it on its head, it might give me an opening by making the reader the hero of the journey instead of the writer. Then I could make it less about me and more about the experience, strength, and hope that I can offer from my journey, from my lived experience, but in the name of serving the reader. And that's what I did. And so once I found that approach, the book kind of wrote itself, and it was just a really... it just flowed really effortlessly and was just a total act of love.
I love it. So how were you able to kind of narrow down, as I mentioned, those 10 or so topics when you began to think about, okay, what are the kind of areas, were those all areas, because you said this book is like part memoir, part kind of how to, were those the areas of your life that you spent the last, you know, you mentioned the last 20 or so years kind of evaluating, or do you see that those being the parts of, quite frankly, gay men's lives that we need the most making sense of? Like, how did you decide, like, to cover all those particular topics?
Yeah, I just made a catalog of all my mistakes. And I was like, let's start there. Yeah. Let's start with, you know, not making all the mistakes that I've made. And, you know, I'm just really logical and linear. So I just broke down life into all its various facets that made sense to me. And I have a lot of experience from, you know, several decades in the corporate world, to all of my work in the 12 steps and talk therapy and life coaching and the Hoffman process and nonviolent communication. I've invested a lot of this. And so I have I have strong points of view and strong opinions. And I think that they can be of service to gay men. I just wanted to be the family that maybe some of these gay men lost along the way or never had.
And it really does. I mean, it really has a familial feel. The tone of the book throughout is very much that you feel at home when you're reading it. And it's really thematically astute when I was reading some of the book. And so you deal with self-acceptance, homophobia, discrimination. You said that you've navigated the corporate world and other types of worlds. Tell our listeners a bit about some of the experiences in your own life that helped shape you write this book without like giving all the deeds away.
Yeah, I grew up in 1980s Tennessee, which was no joke. There was a gay culture, but it was well underground, and I'm sure it was really fun, but that doesn't help you out when you're a child. You don't have access to that culture. You know, even the most well-meaning parents generally don't raise their kids to be culturally gay, so we have to go figure this all on ourselves, all on our own, and find our tribe and, you know, cobble together our life as best we can. But it was more than that. It was also in the shadow of the height of the AIDS epidemic, where sex equaled a terrifying, grotesque death. So that I literally just assumed I'd be dead by the time I was 30. And I assumed that because I was a social outcast, I assumed that I would never be employable. I would have to work at a gay bar or a porn store or something like that, that was sort of on the fringes of society. I just assumed that I'd never be able to be married or have children or any of the dreams that so many people in this country have and maybe take for granted. Retelling my story, figuring out who I was, peeling back the layers to understand who I was separate from the trauma, from the neuroses, and what was really at my core. And that's the process that I was able to leverage to pass forward to the reader in this book. So I go into lots of details about practical, pragmatic wisdom, but also steps you can take, things you can do. This book is not new agey or woo at all. That's just not me. This is practical, pragmatic advice that really anybody could implement, but certainly written from the point of view of my lived experience as a cisgendered white gay man.
Absolutely. And so I wonder, but am I correct in saying that this book is probably for guys our age? Like I'm 40, right? You're probably a little bit older than me. But this book isn't for an 18-year-old coming out right now, right? Or maybe perhaps it is. But it almost seems to me that this book is a how-to guide for those of us gay men who've been doing this for a while and probably been doing a little bit wrong. I could do a little bit better, right? So that I read about your experiences. You, like you said, for example, that homophobia is a form of sexual abuse? Or are you talking about the kinds of ways that we kind of functioned as gay men in the 80s and 90s, especially in the South, and not really being seen? Do you think this book is geared more towards being of a particular age or generation or experience from, frankly, grown men than it is maybe for like a how-to for a kid just coming out today?
Yeah, it's kind of both. You know, I hear from so many different readers of so many different ages, and I'm always fascinated. I think a lot about your question, and I'm always fascinated. Okay, now I've written and released the book. Where is it landing? How is it landing with different segments of the community? And I hear from a lot of men older than me that read it and are very sentimental about the life they might have had things gone a little bit differently, meaning things in society or maybe choices they made because of the bigotry they experienced, that the read it thinking like, oh, I wish I would have had this book when I was coming up, and still feel very touched by it or helps them contextualize a lot of the pain they experienced coming up. And then I hear from guys that are much younger, maybe not 18, but in their early mid-20s that are like, oh my gosh, I had no idea about all this stuff. But of course, the experience, you know, you can make some assumptions, some broad high-level assumptions about the level of trauma a gay man has absorbed and endured based upon his location and the time in which he grew up. And you know, there's never been anything like in human recorded history, like we've been experienced with the panoply of civil rights that gay men now enjoy. There's, you know, we've come so far so fast, it's almost jarring. And so kids these days in their teens and their 20s have it so differently than you and I when we were coming up. It's just, the change has been so radical. And so I was well aware of that when writing the book. So I tried to make it accessible to everybody by speaking at a high concept level. It's not filled with data. It's not filled with jargon. This is like kitchen table wisdom. Like if you would have had access to a mother or father or grandfather to give you this kind of wisdom, sit you down at the kitchen table and tell you the hard truths. That's what I try to do in this book.
Yes, you did. You did that. Yes. Yes,
you really did. And I really, really like the sentiment in the book where you call for gay men who are reading this book to be of service, care, and love for one another and also other communities, because gay men have a unique standpoint and experience that other communities as well as themselves can benefit from. What are those unique qualities about being an out gay man that other communities can benefit from the wisdom of out gay men and the love and care?
Gay men are essential. And that's a political statement. If you're a gay man, I want you to take that and hold that in your heart and feel your inner resistance to that statement. I am essential because of my queerness, because of my membership in this community. Our culture, gay culture, is essential to the health of human culture at large. And to really think about what that means. And I spent a lot of time thinking, okay, if I believe we're essential, then why? Why have gay men always existed? Why is homosexuality, bisexuality, pansexual, why has this always been here? And what benefits does society reap from this culture and this sexual orientation? And there's something unique that we bring. In many cases, not every case, but in many cases, we are the shamans, the peacemakers, the healers. We inject more love into any unit of society, any segment of society. And so we are essential to make peace and increase the peace and the love.
I love that. Yes, keep going. I love it.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that, you know, especially today, now that especially white cisgendered gay men enjoy so much privilege and social standing, that does not mean that we are without our blind spots. And a large part of the book, I try to forcefully peel off the masks of the reader. As gay men, because of the closeted experience, we tend to kind of hide. We tend to, it's a myth that we come out only once. We actually come out every day of our lives in all sorts of ways and all sorts of issues. And we closet ourselves in all sorts of issues. We are all complex collections of privilege and adversity, and gay men are no different. And it's imperative that we leverage whatever privilege we enjoy to lift everybody up. I so deeply believe and Kimberly Crenshaw's theory of intersectionality. And I'm trying to introduce that to so many people. I mean, you know, so many people who don't understand that or don't know that. I'm trying to use this book to subtly start to make them aware, make the reader aware about how when none of us are free unless all of us are free.
Yeah, and we're going to hop a bit more into, I really appreciate it, because Chad, ain't nothing subtle about it. Like, you're very candid that gay racism exists, that gay misogyny exists, and we got to take that all. And so we're going to hop into it in a second, but I really appreciated, Britt, your chapter on friendship, and I want to talk to you a bit more, because Chad, I had to sit and pause with this for a second. We talk about friendships and about gay as gay men and the way in which we relate to one another. And you said that gay men have a tendency to do one of two things, sometimes both. We either cannibalize one another or sexualize one another. That is, if I'm a gay dude and you're a gay dude and we meet, either I'm going to read you, or I'm Chad, I'm, you know, like, you know, she's late. You know, like, we kind of do this thing where we're our own worst critic, our own worst enemies. We cannibalize each other. Or we presume, oh, I'm gay, he's gay, we're going to hop into bed together. Or we got to somehow, you know, and then our friendships suffer because of that. And so talk a bit more about where that comes from, how we get over that, and why that's a problem, about that we either cannibalize each other or sexualize each other when we really could be really good friends.
I'm so glad you asked that. I think there's several dynamics at play, and what I would encourage everybody to do is to read a lot of history, a lot of queer history, because understanding our history is vital to understanding our present culture. So one of the dynamics at play is that in many cases, back in the day, we were literally legally forbid to congregate. Or if we were allowed to congregate, there were really arcane, weird rules at place. Like we couldn't sit down, or we couldn't stand up, or we couldn't dance, or we couldn't do this or that. So that is all to say that in order to find a lover, we had to move fast. Otherwise, we were at risk of blackmail or arrest. And so that led over time to a transactional approach to sexuality. We invented cruising, and cruising was a way to signal and observe others who were into what we were into so that we could facilitate quick sexual transactions and then get on with the rest of our lives. That fragmented us, that drew a line in the sand between our gay life, our sexual life, and our non-gay life, our non-sexual life. And so that even though that dynamic is no longer literally at play today with the advent of Grindr and all that stuff, its tentacles are far reaching. So now we still retain some of that transactional approach to all of our relationships. So when we come to gay friendships, we think about leverage. How can I leverage that gay friendship to get me quick access to sex? So is this person a wingman? Or is this person a threat? Or is this person a partner? Now, this is just one of the dynamics at play. There's many dynamics at play. Another dynamic at play, you talked about reading, was that we try to prepare each other for the cold, hard, brutal truth of the world. And so we try to toughen each other up. And so when somebody young would enter our cultural sphere, we'd immediately pick them apart so we could build them back up again. So it came from a place of love, but it was a tough love. And so we wonder today, all of these dynamics go into this roiling cauldron, this cultural stew. And then we wonder today why there's such an epidemic of loneliness, persistent loneliness among gay men, particularly as we age.
Yes. I mean, I just love it. I hear you talk all
the time. Ain't that a word, y'all?
And so I wanted to talk with you about specifically gay racism and bias and the fragmentation that we have in the LGBTQIA plus community. When did you first recognize that, gay folk can be racist? What was your first encounter with gay racism, queer racism, and or misogyny, so on and so forth? Was that in the nightclub? Was that through friendships? And why is this such an issue and such a problem that continues?
Yeah, I just feel like if there were any way to quantify it, honestly, cis gay men would be the worst. I have to be really honest. I just think that there's a lot of reasons behind that. And one of which is I think that we now enjoy so much social privilege that we feel like we're so close to the pinnacle, which is the straight white cis man. If we kick down our brothers and sisters a little bit, we might get the head nod, which is what we covet the most. There's other dynamics at play as well, but I think it's epidemic and absolutely horrible. Look, in a homophobic society, we are all going to make homophobic choices from time to time, even gay people. I think that's true of racism and sexism as well. I don't have the lived experience there, but I suspect it's the same. So I have a different take on it in that I don't think there are any homophobic people. I think there are only homophobic choices. And what that does, it may sound like a distinction without a difference, but what I'm trying to do is create enough space for grace and redemption, that none of us are beyond the power of grace and redemption. We can all be saved, whatever that means to you. We can all make different choices. Now, having said that, the white, gay, cis men need to take a long, hard look in the mirror. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can log on Grindr and see the racism, sexism, and homophobia all for yourself. It's all right out there in the open. We don't understand that, so many of us gay men don't understand that we are bound by our biases. We are prisoners of our prejudice. We might be kicking people down, but we're kicking ourselves down too. It's like the poison I drink so you will die. It's absolutely critical, not only from a moral standpoint, but purely from a selfish standpoint. We can none of us be free unless all of us are. And if you have to make yourself the center of this equation, just study history. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 is the source of most of gay rights. It's a real straight line, pardon the expression, a real easy line to draw between gay civil rights today and that act, which was on the shoulders of people of color. So we have a lot of soul searching to do. And just because gay men have suffered some, maybe even a lot, does not excuse our behavior, does not indemnify us.
I love it. Our guest today has been author Britt East, author, motivational speaker, lecturer Britt East. The book is called A Gay Man's Guide to Life. Get real, stand tall, take your place. It came out in June. It's available now, y'all, on Amazon, wherever you get your favorite books, Houndstooth Press. Hey, Britt, we could talk to you for hours. I don't know if you take personal clients, but I need some advice. But listen, I'm going to order a copy of this book and send it to my other best friend, Tori, in Baltimore. And I'm going to really, encourage all of my listeners, gay or not, gay men or not, or otherwise, to check out this book. You know, it's certainly for gay men, but I'm sure that there are life lessons in here for lots of folk who need to undo some stuff that they've had to go through, or maybe who don't want to make the same mistakes that you made. So, Britt, man, we really appreciate you being with us. For listeners who want to keep up with you, do you have a website? How can they find you?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is the hub for all of my work. I publish a lot of free articles, free blog posts. I publish every day on social media, all for free. And then, of course, that's where you can find my book. You can buy it through your favorite online store through my website. It'll point you right in the right place, and that's britteast.com.
Britt, thank you so much. Please take care. Come back anytime.
Thank you.
The work we do on Strange Fruit wouldn't be possible without your support. If we've made you laugh,
or made you think,
we hope you'll consider chipping in.
Visit donate.strangefruitpod.org.
That's donate.strangefruitpod.org. Thank you.
So our thanks to Britt for that wonderful conversation. So let's keep it, Doc, in the room of publishing. So yeah. We talked to Britt about his wonderful book, A Gay Man's Guide, and you know, he's taking on issues facing, you know, gay men in the publishing world. And so I was really excited to see another story recently in the Louisville Courier Journal, which is our local newspaper, about a Black woman who is taking on issues affecting Black folk in the world of publishing. And in fact, she is the only Black publishing house. She owns the only Black publishing house in the local area. So guests, please welcome to the show, I guess, publisher Olivia Raven. Olivia, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's a great day. And it's really, I feel so excited to connect more with the local community and learn more about what other people are doing in the world of publishing in Louisville.
Absolutely, because you're right here in the same city as us. Now, hold on, before we go any further, so what is your title? Are you a publisher? Like, do I call you the boss? Like, what is your title? And tell us the name of your publishing house.
Yes, I usually go, like, it's strange, but go by publisher. And the name of my publishing house is Aurelia Leo.
I love it. And so you're here in Louisville, as I mentioned, you are the only Black publishing house in the area. And your company focuses a lot on what they call speculative fiction and sci-fi. For those listeners who don't know, what is speculative fiction? what does it deal with?
Well, it's a little complicated history. Actually, a prominent author in the genre coined the term a couple decades back. But speculative fiction has come to become an umbrella term for horror, science fiction, and fantasy, and genres that kind of straddle those types of genres. So alternative history, slipstream, and things like that. And so speculative fiction has a bunch of definitions, but I usually define it as things that are, you know, they're pondering on things that aren't in the real world. So it might deal with issues that we deal with, but it's going to, you know, have your standard dragons, your ghosts, your things that most everyday people don't encounter.
I love it. So when we think of movies like The Hunger Games or A Wrinkle in Time or The Neverending Story, those things would be speculative fiction.
Yes.
I love it. So you know, as a writer yourself, you go by the pen name Zelda Knight. And mm-hmm. so you talk about in this particular interview you did with the newspaper that you discovered your love of writing at a very early age. Did you see a lot of Black people, Black women, people of color? Did you see people that reflected you in the things that you read growing up?
To be honest, I read widely, but as I talked about in the interview, strangely enough, I never really thought of the race of the authors I was reading. I was more trying to connect with the characters because it was a lot of white characters, a lot of characters that didn't grow up in similar circumstances as me. And so it was a lot of trying to be relational with stories that, you know, weren't one-on-one, which they usually never are, was my experiences. As I got older, I've always had a love of history, so I was reading a lot. My mom always kept books about the civil rights era and different things going on in my hometown of Baltimore and things like that around, even though she's not a big reader because she saw the value of giving me that type of knowledge and letting me have access to it. So I got more concerned about, you know, seeking out stories that talk more about the Black experience, or just talk more about, you know, my realities as a Black woman. And actually being assigned The Bluest Eyes by Toni Morrison in school really opened me up to really seeking out African-American writers. And then as I got older too, seeking out authors in the diaspora around the world.
I love it. And so you're the author of several books. When I was looking on your website, Delta Rangers, the complete series, Omega Sanctuary, Cypher's Curse, and you know, all of them seem to be like extremely interesting and fantastical. Tell our listeners a bit about which book, which novel that you've written that is your fave, or the process of writing it, you know, was a really kind of fave, timeless thing that you thought about.
Yeah, I think because for those listening, I'm a romance writer and I write in different genres of speculative romance, so paranormal romance and different pairings, so LGBT and also different things like that. But I think I've always had an affinity to science fiction romance and science fiction in general. I'm a real big junkie, you know, fan of it. So I think my favorite book, if you take a look at my stuff, is Valor, under my pen name Odyssey Rose. And I think I really loved it because it features a Black heroine. It features her, you know, taking on this kind of oppressive government, this alien invasion, but it also kind of has a sweeping romance that I've come to fall in love with. So that's a series that I poured a lot of my, you know, writing career into, and I'm about to close out this year. And it feels strange. I've started the series in 2017 and now closing it out in 2020. So I think the Unconquered Stars series is the one I would really recommend, and the one that's closest to my heart as one of my fave genres, alien romance being my fave.
I love it. I love, yes, alien romance. Okay. I can't find a boyfriend on this plane, so maybe I need to go. No, maybe I need to go to some alternative universe and find me, you know, a whole boo thing. But no. I wanted to ask you, your publishing house really does focus on Black writers, Black American writers, as well as other writers from the African diaspora. Why is it important to you? Because, you know, quite frankly, stories can be universal, but I mean, Doc and I were just talking a few episodes ago about that movie on Netflix. Doc, what is it? Power Plant? What is it? Project Power.
Project Power.
Yeah, and I was telling Doc how, like, you know, like this movie, which I guess can be considered speculative fiction. I mean, it's kind of fantastical. But I was like, if this movie had white stars, I probably would not have been interested in it. I mean, it's a very basic storyline. And like, if this had been, you know, some run-of-the-mill white actor or even a Hollywood white A-lister, I probably would not have watched it. I'm like, but it felt so cool to watch this series. And again, I'm not usually into sci-fi movies or fantasy movies, but to see this movie take place and the superhero is black, right? And the same thing with the Last Guard. Like, the superhero is a black woman. The person with the magical powers is black. I mean, that's why I don't care about X-Men, but I love me some Storm, right? So the notion of black people being superhuman, black people being magical, right? Like, those things, regardless of whether or not I'm really into the particular genre, you know, it's no different than horror, right? The black serial killer, you know, so why is it important for your house to focus on telling more stories? Well, I can turn on a movie or a TV show or read a book or see a magazine and the fantastical, magical characters look like me.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful question. With Aurelia Leo, I've published widely, I've published non-Black writers, right? But I've always felt that publishing Black people, learning more about stories about Black people and putting it into a fantastical setting is so important, because the whole principle of it is that, you know, we're undefeated. We go on. Like, we can be the people that, you know, explore the stars. We can be the people that do these great things, and we have in the past and the real history. And so I think why it's so important is because, you know, it's not a lot of us, right? You know, we have Milton Davis with Indie Media. We have a couple of other, you know, prominent Black spec publishing houses owned by Black people, but it's not a lot of us, and the publishing industry is wide. And so I think it's really important to now, as I'm doing, focus more on Black writers, because I really do think it's the time for us to be able to tell our own stories and not wait for the mainstream publishing, you know, traditional publishing network to do those things. Like, they've gotten much better about it, but it's the excitement of seeing yourself reflected. I mean, you just never get over it. And I really, like you said, with Storm and other characters, you just never get over it, because it's so often Black people are portrayed so negatively in the media about contemporary circumstances. So it's good for escapism, but it's also good to just have that moment of that power, that pleasure of seeing yourself be fantastic and celebrated.
No, certainly, certainly. And you just published an anthology, Dominion anthology, which houses a number of speculative fiction authors from across the world. What was it like reaching out to those authors, getting submissions, editing the volume, and publishing this huge, great, needed volume? What was that process like?
To be honest, very stressful, but wonderful at the same time. So my co-editor, Pecky, and I, he's from Nigeria. And so I had published one of his short stories before that we later got adapted into an original piece for the anthology. And we got to talking over WhatsApp, and we were like, man, like, you know, there's so many great, you know, anthologies of Black spec fiction out there, like Dark Matter and other things like that. But, you know, it's not that it's none at all, but it's not a lot that deal with this connection between Africa and the African diaspora. And so we got together and we were like, man, we got to do this ourselves. Like, we got to sit down. We got to bring poetry. We got to bring fiction. We got to bring it together. And so Pecky was really invaluable, because he had a lot of connections on the continent that I didn't have that connection. And he had a lot more marketing savvy. And for me, having the infrastructure of the publishing house, you know, knowing how to upload something to Amazon, knowing how to do the nitty gritty things really helped. And so it was really exciting. We had to do a Kickstarter campaign, because the funds we needed, I couldn't pay out of pocket for. It was much more than I usually do to publish work. But we had such a wonderful response. So many people in the industry watching out for us, retweeting, supporting us. And so it was really uplifting and exciting to work with all these authors and bring their stories together. Because one thing reviewers have often said is that even though it features stories from Black people all the way from Australia, from all the way in Australia and even here back home, they said it was a lot of common themes. And I think that really speaks to the connection between African Americans, Africans in the diaspora, and Africans still living on the continent.
I love it. I love it. Well, I'll tell you what, Olivia, it has been so cool having you as a guest today. I do want to point out, you know, shout out to the University of Louisville. You're earning your PhD, your doctorate in PAS at the University of Louisville. Of course, Dr. Story is in the department, so we love PAS, so we are so glad to have you. It's so cute. I heard your little Baltimore accent peeking out over the course of your last, you know, I'm like, and you know, because one of my other best friends is in Baltimore. I lived in D.C. for a bit, so I love old East Coast accent, child. And so I heard your Baltimore accent peeking out, and I love it. But I tell you what, we are really lucky here in Louisville to have you here. So, Olivia, tell our listeners, if people want to go, either maybe send us a mission, or they want to go check out more of your books, how can people find out the books on the publishing house? Do you have a website or anything like that?
Yeah, so if you type in Aurelia, A-U-R-E-L-I-A, Leo.com, that's the main source. You can get connected to the social media, all the publications, learn more about Dominion and the plans Pecky and I have to do much more with African and African diasporic speculative fiction. So website's the main place to go.
I love it. Thank you so much for being with us, and please take care. Come back anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Wow, Doc, what a full, robust show of with two phenomenal guests this week.
Yes, and I love it because, like, even though we interviewed Olivia about speculative fiction and we interviewed Brett about him being an author in Trials and Tribulations, they relate. I mean, in a sense, they're both about LGBTQIA finding their space, finding their healing, whether that's in speculative fiction or the advice that Brett gives in his book. But I loved it. I loved this episode.
Yeah, and you know what? I guess my interests are changing as I get older and more sophisticated. My interests are changing because I didn't think that I was into things like speculative fiction, but I have been enjoying, like, you know, I guess it started when you turned me on to True Blood, right? Yeah. Because I was able to see characters like Lafayette and Tara. You know, I was like, okay, you know, like, because I was thinking, like, so what's the everybody's
movie? Just for so long. I mean, even though we had, you know, speculative fiction giants like Octavia Butler. I mean, her books literally just got on New York Times like just now.
Yeah. And she's been dead
how long. So, I mean, the thing I really like about the interview that they did with Olivia in the Courier Journal was that she talks about the exploitation of Blackness within that genre of speculative fiction, and how for years and for many decades, Black people are just not thought about in the future or the past. So we're not present, even when it comes to ideas of fantasy. They don't give you a whole bunch of characters of color or Black characters especially. And it's like, but this is fantasy, so anybody should be here, right? This is about imagination and creativity. And so how is Blackness or other people of color not a part of that? And so it's been an issue, but now we have more and more Black creatives like Olivia, the writer and director of Lovecraft Country.
You got people like Jordan Peele, who's doing like Get Out, with Black people in horror.
Yes, exactly. Because, you know, it's something where you've had Black folks who have been into sci-fi. You know, my mom's longtime boyfriend, Philster, I mean, he was like a Trekkie. He was way into Star Trek because Star Trek, unlike other shows years ago, had a number of characters of color.
But what about that black woman who was like Captain Kirk's love interest?
Yeah.
That old on-screen kiss or whatever. Yeah.
From Reading Rainbow was in it too, wasn't it? LeVar Burton, he was in it.
LeVar Burton was in a latter iteration, as was Whoopi Goldberg. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So that was like kind of one of the first times where we see in television where they have these Black characters. But I just remember when I was a little kid, I used to really be into the Jetsons and also the Flintstones and watching those cartoons. And I remember I told my dad, I said, I just love these shows, you know, but it's like there's no Black people in the Jetsons. And he said, because, you know, the way that anti-Blackness is set up and white supremacy is set up, white people don't want us to be in the future or the past. We only exist contemporaneously. He told me that. I was like 4 years
old. Yeah, I mean, that's true when you break it down like that. We don't think about that as young people. You know, it's a living thing to think about as a young person, but it's true when you kind of look back, like you know, there's the kind of the meme that goes around now, with the Peanuts cartoon and the one Black characters on one side of the table, the pizza table, and all the other characters. You know, and you look back with different eyes, you're like, well, dang, you know, like, and so, yeah, I was wondering that. I was like, you know, how was this so people can fly, but ain't no Black people, you know what I'm saying? So people got magical powers, but still ain't no Black people. Some, ain't no gay people. You know, like, it doesn't make sense, and that's what I loved about things like the old, you know, I'm not just saying this kind of Brandy Norwood, but the Cinderella, the TV Cinderella with Whoopi Goldberg, where she's the mother, and Angel Dude's the daddy, and Brandy's the prince. You know, like, this is a made-up fairy tale. Of course it should be. I love that about Once Upon a Time, the sitcom on the job on ABC a few years ago that these fantastical characters are of all races. Some of them is queer with it. Some of them is disabled with it. Like, that's how it should be.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And you know, I'm just shading you because your obsession with Brandi Norwood. Okay. And you know me, I'm like Team Monica. So I'm Team Monica.
I know. And on that note, dear listeners, it has been a fun show. But you're right. But anyway, thank you so much.
You know, an author who did do that and did it like quite magically and
who?
Well, it's Toni Morrison with Beloved and also in her book Song of Solomon, where she literally has that parable about Black people being able to fly and escape white supremacy and so on and so forth. And that's in Song of Solomon, and then Beloved, the ghost who comes back. And so Morrison definitely had her hand. So I think that the novel game and the Black creatives who wrote novels like Octavia Butler, like Morrison, kind of started the ball rolling. But you know, a lot of Morrison's books are banned in elementary schools and so on and so forth because they're highly controversial texts and some of that. But it's important. It's important that speculative fiction, that it's important that creative works show the diversity of our world, of the real world that we actually live in, right? Unlike things like Everybody's white and they live in New York and there's no people of color in New York City, right? I mean, Friends, that was the main issue with it. And so it's like, it's not time anymore to have these creative projects, whether it be television shows, films, novels, where there's this expressly white space. I mean, it to me is ridiculous because it does not reflect the world we live in whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, for me, now that I think about it, even though I wasn't really into like sci-fi fantasy, one thing I always loved since I was a young person, a youth, were like African folk tales. And when I think about it, there's really not much difference, right? I loved the story of Kwaku Wenatse and the spider and, you know, there's a book called The People Could Fly, and they were all about how Black people had magical, mystical characters and how they were so wise and, you know, and how the leopard got his spots and, you know, and like all these kind of tales that really merge Black people with magic and wonder. And so I just love it. It's all connected. So yeah, wonderful show. But you know what, Doc, we're out of time for this week. So until next week, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Koja Toshiro, who also composed our theme music. For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.